Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we are diving into a topic that has personally fascinated me for years, the evolution of armor in the Middle Ages.
From gambeson to plate armor, the evolution of protection. Sounds simple at first, but once you dig into it, you quickly realize there's an incredible amount to it.
And it's not just about metal plates and chainmail. Armor was a decisive factor for survival on the battlefield. Whoever had better armor often made it home alive.
That's the core of it. The development over the centuries, well, we're talking about a time span of roughly 1,000 years? From the early Middle Ages to the Renaissance, roughly 500 to 1500 AD?
An incredible amount changed during this time. At the beginning, it was multiple layers of clothing and padding designed to absorb the impact of blows. And by the end, we have those iconic full plate armors that we all know from museums.
And in between lies a fascinating development that was driven by
practical experience. Soldiers learned on the battlefield what worked and what didn't. And the armorers responded accordingly.
This wasn't some ivory tower process. It was learning by doing, in the most brutal sense.
What I personally find fascinating, when you wear armor today, and I've done it plenty of times in reenactment, you immediately feel how complex the balance between protection and mobility is. You want to be protected, but you also need to be able to move.
What does that actually feel like for someone who's never experienced it?
Heavy and warm, but also somehow secure. You understand why people were willing to pay so much for good armor. They knew their lives depended on it.
And that exact balance, protection versus mobility, runs like a common thread through the entire development. Fighters always weighed their options. What do I need in this scenario? How heavy can my armor be?
It wasn't static. Depending on the region, the enemy, the fighting style, armor adapted. Different requirements in the east than in the west. Different for mounted warriors than for foot soldiers.
In this episode, we'll take a closer look at this journey, from the early padded gambesons through chainmail to plate armor. We'll explain why some developments were dead ends and others prevailed.
And we'll also look at what all of this had to do with status and social standing. Because armor wasn't just protection, it was also a status symbol, sometimes even a capital investment.
But we get to that shortly. First, the beginnings.
The gambeson was one of the most important basic armors in Europe. Multiple layers of fabric sewn together into a thick protective padding. Sounds simple, but it was incredibly effective.
How many layers are we talking about?
Depending on quality, it could be over a dozen layers of fabric. Usually linen or hemp for the outer layer, and filling material in between. Raw wool, fabric scraps, hemp fibres. It was quilted in various patterns. Vertical lines were classic, but diamond patterns were also common.
That explains why these things worked so well against strikes. The energy gets distributed across all the layers.
And the protection against cuts was decent too, but when it came to thrusts,
that's where textile armor reaches its limits. A sword point or lance tip penetrates fabric more easily than a broad blade.
And that's exactly where chainmail comes into play. Thousands of metal rings interlocked together. A major improvement against cuts and many thrusts. But against blunt weapons, you still needed additional padding.
The introduction of chainmail was a real game changer. But what many people don't know, there were massive regional differences in how it was made.
You mean east and west?
In the eastern regions, think Byzantine influences, there were often different construction methods, alternating riveted and punched rings, following Roman Byzantine tradition. In the west, from the 12th century onward, the shirts were completely riveted. These differences reflect traditions, metallurgy, and production methods, not blade sharpness.
That sounds like a significant stability advantage for the Western construction method.
Exactly, the difference was crucial. This construction method simply held together better when a point struck, whether from lances, daggers, or pointed swords.
Riveted, fastened, secured. It held together.
And you notice it in the weight. A complete chainmail shirt, a hauberk with long sleeves, weighs 10 to 15 kilos. The weight depends mainly on ring count, ring size, and wire thickness, not primarily on ring type.
Which is immediately noticeable in reenactment. The weight is distributed across your entire upper body. With a belt, you can shift some of it to your hips, but after a long day, you feel every single ring.
That's why the gambeson underneath was so important. Not just as additional protection, but also as padding. Without it, the rings would press into your skin with every hit.
The combination made all the difference. Gambeson plus chainmail? That was the standard for a well-equipped warrior for centuries.
Until they started adding plates on top. The next stage of development. Metal plates over the chainmail to further
improve protection without completely sacrificing the flexibility of the chainmail.
They first tried to combine both. With the so-called coat of plates, plates were riveted on the inside of a fabric or leather carrier. It was robust and functional, not just decoration on a surcoat.
So the transition from the coat of plates through brigandines to articulated plates. Less ornamentation, more function.
And with that, they were on their way to full plate armor. But that's the next chapter. Full plate armor, for many, that's the quintessential image of the medieval knight. But the development toward it was a long road. We're talking about the 14th to 16th century here, a good 200 years of continuous refinement.
And it wasn't a sudden switch. First, individual plates were worn over the chainmail. Then, more and more. Until at some point they realized, with enough plates, you don't need a complete chainmail shirt underneath anymore.
That was the decisive moment. Steel plates offered more comprehensive protection than chainmail alone. But, and this is important, chainmail never disappeared completely. At the joints, under the armpits, in the groin area.
Everywhere plates couldn't fit or would restrict movement too much. That was clever engineering.
The armorers quickly understood. A plate can't cover everything. So chainmail for the flexible areas, steel plates for the rest.
What many people underestimate is the weight distribution. With plate armor, it was much better than with chainmail. With chainmail, a lot of weight rests on your shoulders. Sure, with a belt you can shift some to your hips, but with a well-made plate armor, it's distributed across the entire body. Shoulders, chest, hips, legs.
The total weight of a complete suit of armor was, well, let's say between 20 and 30 kilos. Sounds like a lot at first, but when it's evenly distributed,
then it's surprisingly manageable. The weight doesn't press down on just one spot.
This brings us to a common myth, that knights in their armor could barely
walk and had to be lifted onto their horses with a crane. That's simply not true.
There are contemporary sources describing how armored knights climbed ladders, got up from the ground, even did somersaults. A well-fitted plate armor restricts mobility far less than most people think.
That's also because these suits of armor weren't mass-produced. They were custom-made. Every single plate was fitted to the wearer.
And here's where it gets really interesting. During production, various specialists worked together. Platesmiths who specialized in breastplates. Helmetsmiths solely for helmets. Gauntlet makers for the armored gloves. Polishers who provided the shine.
An entire team for a single suit of armor. How long did that take?
A complete high-quality Italian plate armor, about 120 working days. That was actually faster than an elaborate chainmail shirt. And as early as the early 15th century, plate armor from centers like Milan became even cheaper than chainmail, because it required less material than thousands of individual rings, and the workshops there produced very efficiently.
That explains why they became dominant.
And this team of specialists constantly received feedback. From the knights themselves, from the battlefields. What works? Where do the arrows get through? Where does a plate break under stress?
A continuous improvement process. They were essentially developing iteratively, just without computers. Tested on living subjects.
Sometimes quite literally.
With the increasing importance of cavalry, the balance between protection and mobility became even more critical. A knight on horseback has different requirements than a foot soldier.
The legs need to be mobile enough for riding, but still protected against infantry weapons from below. The arms need to wield lance and sword, but the armpits can't be left exposed to
thrusts from below. Every combat situation presented new requirements.
This wasn't a static technology. Between the early plate shirts and the fully articulated knight's armor of the late 15th century, there's a world of difference. Every generation improved, refined, optimized.
Driven by one single goal, keeping the wearer alive. And at the same time, armor became something else, a status symbol. A high-quality suit of armor in the Middle Ages was much more than just protection. It was a statement. It showed everyone on the battlefield, here stands someone with money, with status, with power.
And that had very practical consequences. Whoever wore a magnificent suit of armor was treated differently in battle.
That's exactly where ransom comes into play. A knight in expensive armor, you didn't want to kill him. You wanted to capture him. Alive, he was worth a fortune.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
It was a regular business model. Knights recognized each other by their coat of arms, by the quality of the armor, and instantly knew, this one is valuable.
The most famous example is probably Richard the Lionheart, who, on his way back from the Crusade,
was captured, 1192, near Vienna. And the ransom? 150,000 marks of silver. That was approximately 35 tons, 3 times the annual income of the English crown. Although, in reality, only 2/3 were actually paid in silver. For the rest, England had to provide hostages.
England had to melt down church treasures, levy special taxes. The country took years to recover from it. Richard was held captive for 14 months.
This shows how valuable a living nobleman was. And armor was the first signal. Don't kill this man. He'll bring money.
The Crusades, by the way, had a strong influence on armor development. Knights from Europe came to the Near East and quickly realized our heavy armor is, how do you say it, an enormous burden in this climate.
In the heat of the Holy Land, a European chainmail shirt was torture. The knights learned practical tricks there. Light surcoats over their armor to protect themselves from the sun.
And they brought Eastern influences back to Europe. Helmet designs, for example. Head protection was essential in combat. A blow to the head was almost always fatal.
Helmets evolved parallel to the rest of the armor. From the simple nasal helmet, through the great helm, to the elaborate visored helmets of later plate armor.
And with helmets, you can also see this balancing act between protection and practicality. A great helm protects excellently, but you can barely see or hear anything. In close combat, on foot, that's a real problem.
That's why many knights had multiple helmets. A heavy one for the initial cavalry charge, a lighter one for fighting on the
ground. The situation determined the equipment.
This applied to the entire suit of armor. Too much protection made you slow and immobile. Too little, and you wouldn't survive the first hit. Depending on the expected combat scenario, choices were weighed.
And as we've already discussed, a foot soldier needed different armor than a mounted knight. A siege fighter, different from someone in open battle. There simply was no one-size-fits-all solution.
And all these factors, status, ransom potential, climate adaptation, fighting style, influenced how armor was designed. It was a complex interplay.
Armor told a story about its wearer, where he came from, what he could afford, what battles he expected.
Looking back now, from the simple gambeson through chainmail to full plate armor, we see a development process spanning almost 1,000 years.
Driven by entirely practical experience. Every battle, every new weapon, every bit of feedback from soldiers influenced the next generation of armor.
And it was never just about pure protection. Armor was always also a mirror of society. Who wore it, what they could afford, what status they held.
Technology, craftsmanship and social structures all united in a single piece of metal and fabric.
Is the
the craftsmanship behind it, the traditional methods, the collaboration of various specialists, that was precision work at the highest level.
And this fascination lives on today. In reenactment, in LARP, wherever people want to keep history alive, armor plays a central role.
There's something special about wearing a piece like this and feeling how much knowledge and skill went into it. It connects us to the past.
And with that, we've come to the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed this glimpse into the world of medieval armor.
If you want to learn more about topics like this, at battlemerchant.com, you'll find not only an extensive range of armor and equipment, but also many more fascinating articles for history enthusiasts on the blog.
Thank you very much for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.